Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The politics of presidential 1040s today, why Citigroup shareholders are an angry bunch, and it ain't easy being green. The Freakonomics of corporate good intentions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 18th of April. Good to have you with us. In the American corporate calendar, spring is a special time. It's annual meeting season, when shareholders gather from far and wide to inspect the investments they've made, and they are a restless group this year. Citigroup shareholders have given a big N.O. to a nearly $15 million pay package for CEO Vikram Pandit. The Dodd-Frank financial reform law does, in fact, require companies to hold a shareholder say-on-pay vote. But here's the catch, and you knew it was coming. That vote is not legally binding. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
Say I'm the board of directors for a company you own stock in. I tell you how much I'd like to pay my CEO, lots and lots, and you, the shareholder, get to vote on it. Remember, I don't have to pay attention, so will I?
There's no doubt that boards pay attention, no doubt.
That's finance professor Steve Kaplan at University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He says last year, more than half the shareholders in Stanley Black & Decker voted against executive pay. So the tool company made changes. It required its executives to hold stock longer and...
And they reduced the pay of their CEO.
John Lundgren took a $19 million pay cut, but he still made almost $14 million. But Kaplan says the vast majority of companies got a thumbs up on executive pay. Companies with grumpy shareholders face a balancing act. Teo Francis writes for Footnoted.com, a blog published by Morningstar.
Essentially, what they're trying to do is find a middle ground between the critics and the executives, because, of course, the executives presumably believe they're worth every penny that they've been paid.
And Citigroup says it's taking Tuesday's shareholder vote seriously. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Should you happen to believe you're not Stanford material or that you can't get into Penn or Princeton or UC Berkeley, good news today. A startup company called Coursera has announced it's going to team up with those big-name schools to offer courses online for free. You won't actually get college credit, and the course subjects are limited, but there's a pretty clear upside for the students. Question is, what's in it for the schools? From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The University of Michigan can charge out-of-state students roughly $40,000 a year. So why would it give away courses for free?
You know, I just don't think it's an apples-to-apples comparison. It's a totally different experience.
Martha Pollack is vice provost for academic and budgetary affairs at Michigan. She says the university plans to start with 7 courses on the Coursera website on topics like finance, electronic voting, and fantasy and science fiction. She says no doubt students working face-to-face with professors get a richer education.
But by using Coursera, we are able to reach out to people who couldn't otherwise come to campus and give them a glimpse of what our education is like.
Some of those people might even turn into paying students. 2 professors at Stanford started Coursera after their own free online courses attracted more than 100,000 students, more than half from other countries. Now they've attracted $16 million in venture capital. And the business plan is pure Silicon Valley startup. Co-founder Daphne Kohler says there isn't one.
The current ethos in Silicon Valley is that if you construct a website that keeps users coming back again and again and engaging with the site, then there will be found a way to bring in revenue that would make it self-sustaining.
One idea is to charge to connect employers with top students. But as one investor put it on his blog, if Coursera gains traction with students and universities, the rest will take care of itself. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This is going to be a pretty interesting election this fall for a whole lot of reasons, obviously, one of which is that it's a race between a rich guy and a really rich guy and what Americans might make of that. We know how much the president makes because, A, we pay him, but also because he told us Monday when he released his tax returns. Governor Romney hasn't released his. He's filed for an extension. But does that adjusted gross income line on your 1040 affect how you govern? Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has that story.
If Mitt Romney wins the White House, he'd be our fourth wealthiest president ever. That's according to Forbes, anyway. George Washington was number one because of all his land and his slaves. But does a candidate's personal wealth say anything about how they'd govern?
A question like that is impossible to answer until it actually happens.
Presidential historian H.W. Brands.
Because candidates for president think in one way. Presidents have to deal in a different milieu.
As do governors. While governor of Massachusetts, Romney tried to close tax loopholes favoring big business. And Princeton historian Julian Zelizer says Romney wasn't thinking about the wealthy when he pushed through his biggest program there.
He passed health care, which was a pretty big extension of government, even though he himself is philosophically opposed to government.
Business historian John Steele Gordon says Romney's wealth might even work to the advantage of the 99%.
My guess is that Romney would tend to bend over backwards in order not to appear to favor the rich.
Perhaps, but political scientist Morris Cunningham at UMass Boston says in the end, he believes Romney's just more comfortable with policies that favor the well-heeled.
He believes that the upper class serve the nation well and the nation should do what it can to help them prosper and drag the rest of us along, if you will.
And nobody expects Romney to pull an FDR. He leaked the tax returns of some of the country's wealthiest tax avoiders. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, started bad, bounced back, faded at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Buffett rule was blocked by Senate Republicans on Monday, but that doesn't mean President Obama's given up trying to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans. On a campaign swing through Ohio and Michigan today, he was right back at it. Mitt Romney argued his case in a speech in North Carolina, which is probably the back-and-forth way it's going to go till Election Day. Commentator Robert Reich says on taxes, we ought to let history be our guide.
One of the most pernicious economic falsehoods you'll hear during the next 7 months of political campaigning is there's a necessary trade-off between fairness and growth. By this view, if we raise taxes on the wealthy, the economy can't grow as fast. Wrong. Taxes were far higher on top incomes in the three decades after World War II than they've been since, and the distribution of income was far more equal. Yet the American economy grew faster in those years than it's grown since tax rates were slashed in 1981. This wasn't a post-war aberration. Bill Clinton raised taxes on the wealthy in the 1990s, and the economy produced faster job growth and higher wages than it did after George W. Bush slashed taxes on the rich in his first term. If you need more evidence, consider modern Germany, where taxes on the wealthy are much higher than they are here, and the distribution of income far more equal. But Germany's average annual growth has been faster than that in the United States. You see, higher taxes on the wealthy can finance more investments in infrastructure and education, which are vital for growth and the economic prospects of the middle class. Higher taxes on the wealthy also allow for lower taxes on the middle, potentially restoring enough middle-class purchasing power to keep the economy going. As we've seen in recent years, when disposable income is concentrated at the top, the middle class doesn't have enough money to boost the economy. What we should have learned over the last half century is that growth doesn't trickle down from the top. It percolates upward from working people who are adequately educated, sufficiently rewarded, and who feel they have a fair chance to make it in America. Fairness isn't incompatible with growth. It's necessary for it.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's got a new book out. It's called Beyond Outrage, What's Gone Wrong with Our Economy and Our Democracy, and How to Fix It. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Something's going to happen in Japan early next month that hasn't happened since 1970. For the first time in more than 40 years, none of Japan's electricity will be generated by nuclear power. After the earthquake and meltdown at Fukushima last March, reactors in Japan have been shut down one by one, and the trade minister said today the last one is going to be turned off before any of the others can be restarted, if they're restarted. Marketplace's Scott Tong has the story.
You may have heard this joke before. If your internet goes out, you're back to 1979. If your power goes out, you're back to 1879. No electricity, no modern economy. So it's astounding to Andrew DeWitt at Rikkyu University in Tokyo that Japan has shut down every one of its 54 nuclear reactors except one.
Well, the removal of that generation capacity is simply unprecedented. This is a big, big deal.
The end of Japan's nuclear industrial complex? Too soon to tell, but we do know about the rise, how Japan, of all places, fell in love with the atom.
Exactly 3 days after Hiroshima, a B-29 set out for Nagasaki.
The Nagasaki blast in 1945 killed 50,000 people. Kido Soeichi was there walking with his mom. He was five.
I heard a plane, and as soon as I looked up, I saw the flash. I was thrown 60 feet. Half my face was burned. My mother was burned all over her body.
By the 1950s, President Eisenhower was marketing U.S. atomic energy as an electricity source around the world. Atoms for peace.
Against the dark background of the atomic bomb, the United States does not wish merely to present strength, but also the desire and the hope for peace.
Japan bought in and developed a domestic energy source instead of importing fossil fuels at unpredictable prices. Here's Purdue University's Daniel Aldridge.
Many politicians and bureaucrats envisioned Japan's future not in terms of a military race, but rather in terms of an economic one, with energy being the engine driving forward that economic growth.
Nuclear proponents fashioned a powerful political and economic coalition and pushed Japan to a goal of more than 50% nuclear. It's one of the world's most complex technologies, says Aldridge.
They're more complicated than any 757 cockpit. They've got more miles of tubing than any skyscraper you've ever visited. They are interconnected complex machines that require strong oversight.
Then came Fukushima. Public support for nuclear fell from 80% to less than 10. Reports surfaced that Fukushima's parent company had falsified safety reports. Utilities had ignored warnings about tsunami risk. Now the question became,
do you want to preserve a power economy that got you into serious trouble, that is not going to be a world-beating growth engine?
One by one, Japanese nuclear reactors shut down for routine maintenance, and local officials refused to restart them. By next month, DeWitt says it's likely every one of Japan's nuclear reactors will be dark. But here's the thing. People don't miss it. Here in Osaka, where workers are loading container ships, utilities have filled the void with coal and gas-fired power. That's fine with restaurant owner Keiku Mayakawa.
It's scary to depend on nuclear power. There are so many plants in this country. After Fukushima, it means accidents can happen anywhere.
I heard a lot of that sentiment. One of the few nuclear supporters is Nobuo Nishida. He runs a workshop making industrial springs, and he worries that without nuclear, the price of energy will rise.
If they raise the price of electricity, it will be harder for us. I don't know how long I can keep this going.
Another strike against nuclear is a new subsidy this summer, promoting renewable sources like wind and solar energy. Similar programs in Europe, known as the feed-in tariff, have jump-started the sectors there. Economist Kenichi Oshima.
This will be a big turning point for Japan. Japanese industries have good basic technology. First, renewables will develop in the domestic market and then expand overseas.
Last week, nuclear supporters pushed back. Officials declared two reactors fit to restart this summer. But most think any restarts would be limited. A big test will come this summer, a time of peak power demand. If Japan has any blackouts, citizens may scream to bring back nuclear. If not, it'll reinforce the perception they don't need it. In Osaka, Western Japan, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, if you were to ask me, the global 1,000 corporations, you know, how many of them are sincere and seriously about sustainability and long-term value creation? We're probably at 15%.
Yeah, that's not good. Freakonomics and corporate social responsibility, CSR, as they say. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average reversed 82 points today, 0.6%, closed at 13,032. The NASDAQ slipped 11 points, 0.3%, finished at 3,031. Boy, that's a lot of threes and ones in there. The S&P 500 fell 5 points, that's 0.4%, ended things at 1385. Lackluster earnings from two tech heavyweights pulled down the big board today. IBM delivered profits, but computer hardware sales were weak. Shares of Big Blue sank 3.5%. Intel drained 1.8% after the chipmaker said profit margin shrank. Apple, should you be curious, fell 0.2%. Warren Buffett issued a bullish outlook on his cancer diagnosis, but investors were cautious anyhow. Berkshire Hathaway declined 1.3% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. A look at the health of the housing market. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for March. And food industry professionals are gathered in Washington for the annual Food Safety Summit. That wraps up tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The snow report from the Squaw Valley Ski Resort today up in Lake Tahoe is kind of 96-inch base. Nothing new in the past 24 hours. Spring conditions, it says, which are always kind of a mixed bag. That's not a bad metaphor, actually, for the ski industry as a whole. There's a lot of pressure to consolidate in the face of a weak economy. And here in California, two big resorts up in Tahoe want to merge and become the biggest ski area in the country. Just one thing stopping the deal, though, the guy who owns the land in between. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has this profile of the man in the middle.
This season, the Lake Tahoe ski resort Squaw Valley bought its neighbor, Alpine Meadows. Andy Wirth is CEO of Squaw Valley Ski Holdings.
The two resorts combined provide over 6,000 skiable acres within 10 minutes of each other. So they offer something that nobody else has in this marketplace, at least in Northern California.
I'm surprised that you didn't say that it's the biggest resort in the U.S. if you take them together.
Well, that's fundamentally inaccurate. We're not connected. We're not together as one resort. We connect the resorts with a convenient shuttle.
No, it was awesome.
I tried taking that shuttle.
Okay, here at the Squaw Alpine bus stop at 201.
It took me 35 minutes to get from one resort to the other, and that only got me to the parking lot. But the ride doesn't bother snowboarder Rusty Bailey.
It's nice to be able to ski both mountains whenever you want. Get a pass, works both places, got a bus goes in between. I think it's really convenient.
No. What would be really convenient would be a chairlift that connects one resort with the other. That's likely to happen eventually, but it all depends on local landowner Troy Caldwell.
We own a piece of property. It's 460 acres. It lies between Squaw Valley Ski Area and Alpine Meadow Ski Area.
He paid less than $500,000 for the land more than 20 years ago. To raise the money, the Caldwells liquidated everything.
We basically got rid of our home and our spec house and whatever we could to make it work. We ended up living in a trailer when we moved on the property.
That trailer was without electricity or running water for about 6 years. But no matter the hardship, Caldwell resisted offers to sell.
We've been offered in the $45 million category for it.
That's right. He turned down $45 million so he could build his own minimal ski resort. He has no partners. Caldwell is building it on a budget of $50,000 to $60,000 a year.
But I own everything. I don't have any mortgages. We're able to make $50,000, $60,000 kind of work for us.
He does a few odd jobs like parking cars for the Alpine Meadows Resort. At the end of the day, Caldwell shuttles skiers to the parking lots in his own personal truck.
I'm going up, you guys. You need a ride. You got boots, poles. No, you got it all.
Caldwell is a multi-millionaire on paper. So why is he spending his time parking cars?
The ski areas pay us to park the cars there. And that's also a good source of revenue for us.
He also saves money when people like retired banker Pete Crosby volunteer to work on his planned ski resort called White Wolf.
Like Troy told me, he said,
if I get a lot of cash in my wallet, it's not good when I'm driving in the car because it bothers my back. So he said, I don't need a fat wallet.
Caldwell resists taking a partner because he doesn't want to sacrifice control. That would be a smart move, says ex-banker Pete Crosby, who used to work with entrepreneurs speculating on real estate development.
They want to take control. They've got a lot of money invested in it. They want to control it, and they're going to impose their own ideas. In many cases, they'll change it substantially, primarily for economic reasons.
Caldwell doesn't seem to let economic considerations affect his plans. When he runs out of money, he puts his project on hold. He expects it could take another 10 to 15 years to get his ski resort going. Squaw Valley Management hopes it won't take that long to strike a deal with Caldwell. In Alpine Meadows, California, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It's the hidden side of, wait, what is it? Yes, everything. Dubner, good to have you back.
Hey, Kai, good to be back. I bring to you today the topic of good citizenship,
good
corporate citizenship, to be precise.
Yes.
I bet you have heard this kind of thing a million times before.
In my particular job, I'm trying to have the biggest impact in terms of reductions in greenhouse gases. And so I get to think of places that have nothing to do with Google's core business, but where we can really have a big impact in reducing greenhouse gases.
Yeah, okay. Hey, not really. Haven't heard that, but okay.
Well, that's a Google promotional video, yes. The kind of thing that you see more and more these days, and where firms talk about their high level of corporate social responsibility, or CSR, yep. Which I'm guessing you have heard of, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Sustainability. Come on. That's what we do.
There you go. So I'm here to tell you today, Kai, that some companies who tout their high CSR are not being 100% sincere all the time.
I am shocked to find out there's gambling going on.
Now, I want you to listen to Georg Kell, who is executive director of the United Nations Global Compact, which promotes good corporate citizenship,
okay. Particularly
sustainability.
Very well.
Well, if you were to ask me the global 1,000 corporations, you know, how many of them are sincere and seriously about sustainability and long-term value creation? Our own implementation survey and others done by other leading think tanks will probably suggest we are probably at 15%.
No, come on. That's scandalous.
It's a low number.
15%.
It's not a high number. Yeah. So the way it worked, Kell's group signed up about 7,000 companies,
yeah.
And the UN's list of good corporate behaviors includes not only sustainability, but practicing human rights, good human rights,
yeah.
and fighting corruption. Here's Kell again.
All right.
And it's by and large working, except that roughly half of our participants who joined actually don't live up to that. So they either they lose the focus or they don't have the dedication to continue that pathway. And unfortunately, we have to expel them.
Wow, they throw them out.
They expel them. Now, you can get back on. And to be fair, sticking to your CSR promise is a little bit reminds me of sticking to a diet. You know, even if
right.
the spirit is willing, the flesh can be weak. It is a lot of work. So getting a high CSR score means that you have to not only pollute less, but you also have to treat your employees and your customers ethically.
Yeah.
You have to set long-term goals that may not necessarily help your quarterly earnings, which is what the street cares about. And, of course, you have to take time to constantly report your progress to places like the UN.
Yeah, but wait a second. What does all that do for your bottom line, right? Because companies are in business to make money and, you know, shareholder value and all that stuff. And does this pay off?
It sounds like it'd be a bad bet for
right.
the bottom line, doesn't it, Kai? Isn't
yeah.
that what you're thinking?
That's
yeah?
where I'm
well,
going, yes.
Unfortunately, you're a little bit off on this. The good news is that...
Again, I'm wrong with Stephen Dubner.
The good news is there is an upside, apparently. So George Serafim at the Harvard Business School has just finished an analysis of 180 U.S. companies over
yes.
the course of 20 years to measure the effect, if any, that being a good corporate citizen has on a company's bottom line. Now,
okay.
he did this by comparing the financial performance of firms that exhibited high sustainability behavior versus low sustainability firms.
Okay.
We found that the high sustainability group outperforms the low sustainability group in terms of stock market performance. And also, we found that the high sustainability groups outperforms the low sustainability groups in terms of operating performance as well. Whether you look at the return on assets or return on equity, you find strong outperformance.
All right, so you spend the money, you make more money. So is the lesson here that all you got to do is hire a chief sustainability person and bang, you're going to do it?
No. Okay, no more than if I buy a scale, I start to lose weight automatically, right? In fact, you have to be careful interpreting the findings of Seraphim's study. It may be that being a good corporate citizen is good for business in the long run, or it may be that the kind of company that's more likely to be a good citizen in the first place is right. also more likely to be a profitable company. Whichever direction the arrow is pointing, however, which we don't really know yet, it does look like at least one truism in the business world is actually true, which is that you really can do well by doing good.
There you go. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Kai.
Yeah, man.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs at novonordisk-us.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, Dick Clark has passed away.
Live from the NBC studios in Burbank, California, it's Dick Clark's Live Wednesday.
And now, here he is, the star of our show, Dick Clark!
The focal point of the brand new year of 1976. Happy New Year's Rockin' Eve!
Clark was 82. He had a heart attack. Depending on how old you are, you've probably got different memories of him. You might have heard some of them there. American Bandstand, New Year's Rockin' Eve. Dick Clark Productions, his company, did the Golden Globes and the American Music Awards. For me, it's always going to be the guy who hosted the $20,000 pyramid, which I got to watch when I was a kid, when I was homesick from school. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gave back 82 points, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ off 11. That's 0.3%. The S&P 500 down 5 points, 0.4%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.